Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On the show today, Rasheen Murphy, the musician and singer whose new releases are looking specifically to make you move. She'll be here to discuss her latest collaborations and ongoing musical explorations.
We'll also be hearing from influential US artist Mary Kelly, whose new show, Face to Face, looks at conflict, confrontation, connection, and more.
And we'll be looking back over some of the more unlikely tales from medical history with writer Thomas Morris, author of The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Carlotta Ribello will be looking ahead to some of next week's news today. And we'll have some music too. That's right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. An action-packed Monocle Weekly ahead. Shall we on with a preview of next week's news today?
I think we ought to.
Here she is, it's Carlotta Ribello. Welcome, good afternoon, Carlotta. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be here with you guys on Sunday. We need to obviously mention what Brazilians are waking up to today. It's the election for president, which can be quite decisive for the Americas, whether or not the country is shifting to the right due to the far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro, which seems to be leading in the polls. We've been hearing from our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's in Brazil. Has been in Brazil all week, and I'm sure this is a story that's going to continue throughout the week for us as well.
We'll have the latest updates. They get the results. They don't mess around in Brazil. They crack on with the results, so we should know by tomorrow. We'll be covering it, of course, on our news programmes. Let's hope Bolsonaro doesn't win.
Well, can only hope.
Yeah. That's a depressing thought.
Well, let's move
something
on.
Something more. You got any sunshine for us?
I do, but I'm going to save that. Okay. To
more rain first.
A tiny bit, just a gentle rain. At the end of the week, on the 12th, it is Spain's National Day. Now, obviously, this includes the annual military parade that King Felipe presides over, but it's always a contested holiday, especially since the referendum on the independence of Catalonia. And if we could see anything that is a barometer of how this day might actually draw a couple of protests was that Catalonia had its own Independence Day at the beginning of September, and at least 1 million people were estimated to be out on the streets demonstrating in support. So it's more than likely that there will be protests on this day, some charged political commentary, and I think it really is going to be a test to where the tension in the country stands at the moment and what to expect from how this is going to develop.
There's a great deal of complexity.
Exactly. But will you be reporting on this one, the World Pea Throwing Competition?
I'm going.
The World Pea Throwing Competition happening a bit south from London in East Sussex. Now, I had never heard of this this sport, because apparently it is a sport.
And we're talking about green vegetables here.
Yeah, yeah.
Not vials of urine.
Not vials of urine. Competitors throw 3 peas each to see which one runs the longest distance. The record is 44 metres.
Hold on, 44 metres. What are they? They're throwing them down a street. They're rolling them.
Yeah, they're rolling them.
It's pea rolling.
The name is World Pea Throwing Competition.
But they are rolled.
Probably.
Have you been watching videos on YouTube?
Yeah, I was trying to figure out, get the, you know, the craft, the skill needed.
What's the secret to pea throwing technique?
apparently, they pride themselves of saying that this is a relatively new custom, but it's been going on since the 90s.
There you go. That's our Carlotta Ribello signing off on next week's news and pea rolling championships to follow in the days ahead. Carlotta, thank you. In just a moment, we'll be hearing from Rasheen Murphy. Don't go away. Rasheen Murphy is a musician whose output has ranged from the chart-topping sounds of former band Moloko, as you just heard there, to her latest project, a series of one-off 12-inch singles released this summer in collaboration with producer Morris Fulton and London's The Vinyl Factory.
Her latest tunes have been created with pretty much one purpose in mind, to make you dance. So let's have a listen to one. This is the excellently named Jacuzzi Roller Coaster.
We elevate to a higher degree, and a degree. We sit inside.
Rasheen Murphy and Maurice Fulton there with Jacuzzi Roller Coaster, and she joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hello.
Lovely to have you here. The video has just come out this week for Jacuzzi Roller Coaster. Amazing.
Thank you.
And if Twitter's anything to go by, quite laborious.
Yes. It was insanity to try and make it. Yeah, I lost all sorts of people along the way. The post guy left me last week in the middle of the week. Then I lost the editor. I think he didn't think I knew what I was doing. It was very complicated. Then I got two Hungarian lads in over the weekend. We worked 19-hour days, 3 days in a row, got it finished. And to be honest, to give the post guy some credit from last week, most of the creative stuff was done. But when you do post like this, it's a lot of rendering and fiddling at just nonsense. And takes a great deal of patience.
And if people can follow your feed and they'll see your sort of Twitter feed, Rasheen, they'll see that you had this sort of interesting, quite compelling metaphor actually for the release of that.
Oh, yes,
that video.
Yes, that's where you're getting it from.
Is that still.
There's a certain amount of build up.
Yeah, exactly. But then that big moment, a sort of euphoric
moment
perhaps.
It comes out.
Is that. Do you still. Can you enjoy that process? And I sense from this.
I'd say I really did this time. Most of the time you don't actually get, you know, there's a letdown, there's a sort of. But it was just such a pain making this video. And the whole year's been difficult. You know, it's been the hardest year of my life. It hasn't been the worst year because it definitely wasn't a sad year. I don't know if you can respond to this, but I just had a hard year. It was very hard. Everything that I did, I've massive obstacles in my way and had incredible amount of work on my plate, and it just seemed to pile up more and more. And so getting this out has been really a super relief, and I'm so happy it's out there and everybody loves it, and I'm dead chuffed.
Are you a bit of a believer then in the idea that one must in some way sort of suffer for one's art, or is that a bit of a misnomer? I mean, is it good for the creative process, for the enjoyment of the end product, if there's been, whether it's just pure hard graft or something more complicated going on?
Well,
with
I mean, I think there's a bit of both going on with me, because the singing part and the writing songs part has become, and probably always was, fairly easy for me. You know, it was like, it's an easy thing. I open my gob and singing comes out and it's quite nice. And that's not, I didn't even have to learn, like people have to learn to play an instrument and stuff. So that just sort of was there, took that totally for granted. Didn't even see myself as a musician or a singer when I started, and came into it from a kind of point of view of just being a bit aggravating and sort of conceptual and stuff like that, and began to sing after I signed the record deal. So, yeah, I mean, that is not difficult. But the rest of it, I kind of must like a bit of difficulty, because I take on the rest of it as well. And I really enjoy directing. I'm addicted to directing, actually, more so than I am to singing and performing now, I think. I really find it incredibly stimulating to do. But it's very, very challenging. And it's very challenging just on a concentration level, you know, all these different elements to it. Even just coming up with the idea, having to sit down and concentrate on a piece of music, and what am I going to do, and what are the things that I've got at hand. And it's hard. It's hard work. And I guess I would always want more than I've got. So with these videos, I've been working with extremely small budgets. And I think to a degree I've stretched sort of time and space, or warped reality, you know, and they look like much more expensive things. But even if I had, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds, I'd probably be trying to make, you know, Gone with the Wind with it, you know, so which wouldn't look like millions of pounds. Do you know what I mean? So that's kind of what you do with film, I think. And with music, it's different. It is compartmentalized, the process, but for me as the singer, less so than perhaps the producer. So I'm not having to sort of make sure everything's filed correctly and, you know, the small print's done, you know, metaphorically in the music.
I suppose then, you know, with the music, you're also working these tracks that have been released over the summer. You've been doing with Maurice Fulton, who's a legend, kind of amazing producer. And that process.
Utter pain in the arse.
Really? Please expand.
I think probably the most difficult working relationship I've ever had. And he was totally, he's no problem with me telling people. But he really, you wouldn't work with Maurice Fulton to tell him what to do, you know. And if I tried to say, well, you know, can we do this, that, whatever. If he had played it in the club that weekend and it had worked, there was no touching the thing. And in fact, he told me that I could either take it or leave it a couple of times, literally, that he would delete everything if I just didn't shut up, you know. So he's really a strong character. And you don't work with Maurice for any other reason. And it's coming from straight from the gut with him, you know. It isn't intellectualized. It isn't sort of really thought out. It's like he knows innately what he's got to do. And that's what you hear in his music. So I accepted it in the end, but it didn't, for that reason, feel like an album, you know, like a Roisin Murphy album. I didn't feel I could slick it to that point or stamp it to that point. And so I decided to go with it as a club cultural object, you know, as a thing that was about, it either worked in the club and it worked or it didn't. And the 8 tracks that ended up coming out, which were less than what we did together, work in that environment in one way or another, or they relate to that environment authentically in one way or another. And so that was helpful in terms of what I did with the videos, in terms of what I did with the visual, in terms of the whole conversation around the work, you know. So that was why I put it as 4 pieces of vinyl or 4 releases. I mean, it's available digitally, but they're staggered. They're staggered releases, 2 tracks at a time. And they're, for the most part, you know, have done radio edits of things, but they're long tracks. They're for the club, you know, they're from that environment, and authentically so. And it helped me with the visual. It's really good when you're making visual for a big project like this to have an anchorage as well, you know. And that just really, I just took it as it's pretty obvious, but I took it as red, you know, and it helped me.
On that point, though, in terms of the creative process, I don't know, how different is your creative approach, I suppose, depending on where the songs are designed to be experienced? Like, is it different if you're musing on something and it becomes just a little, you know, it's a vocal note that you've got, or if it's something that's very directly for the club scene, it's dynamic, it's for dancing? How's your creative experience different?
In a way, and having said all that I've said, I did need somebody like Maurice to put the foot down as well, because I have a tendency to finesse and to, you know, and I think club music is interesting in that, you know, I mean, I met Giorgio Moroder to go to work with him. He wanted to do a track with me or something for his album a few years ago. And it never happened, because when he sent me the tracks, I was like, God, this is not like what I expected at all, you know. And I had conversations with him, and he couldn't stop talking about David Guetta. And it was really at the height of the David Guetta thing as well. And I was very surprised by this, and because to be honest with you, I consider what he did some of the greatest records ever made, you know, that still you put on a system still like beats the hell out of like brand new records, you know. It's unbelievable what he did. And plus also, she was incredible too, you know, Donna Summer. It's very underrated how amazing a singer and a songwriter she actually was. And all this emotion and this darkness tied up in it and all this. And I was saying all this too, and it was kind of like I was talking to the wall, you know. And I just don't know, like, I'm not going to make a judgment. I don't know where his music came from. I do know that he worked in advertising in Italy, advertising music, before he kind of got struck onto the disco thing. And I do know that he more or less stopped when, you know, after they burnt all the disco records, and in America it just became a non-functional thing. It became a thing that just wasn't selling a lot of records anymore, you know. And there's a sort of bluntness and a kind of like, it either works or it doesn't. That's one level, like it either works or it doesn't in the club, you know, that is almost removed from being a creative. It's more like a kind of artisan, you know, that you understand your craft, you do your craft, and you don't let any nonsense get in the way. And then there is this thing of like, obviously he seemed to me, well, maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed to me that he was interested in things that were very successful, you know, as well, rather than something underground, brave, experimental, and all these things, you know. And that's where I'm coming from as an artist, you know. And it's a sort of keep it simple, stupid mentality, or, you know, it's a sort of like, what, you know, what's going to make people dance, like, you know. And then another situation is maybe how I work with Eddie Stevens, who I made last albums with, who's like my, you know, cosmic brother, you know. I've known him for 25 years. His beautiful story, how he came around after all these years of being my musical director and came around to being my producer and writer and all these things. And he's a totally different kettle of fish. And it's then me that's sort of holding him back from overdoing it. So every single time I do work with a new collaborator, it's a new thing. I'm lucky that way, you know, because that means I can have a new era every time.
It's interesting that you can kind of have that even within a relationship that isn't necessarily like defined by sort of friendship or like a creative process that isn't necessarily fun or effortless, that like some conflict can still lead to this sort of desired outcome. I'm really interested in, you know,
but you don't need the conflict either.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so I'm
I
open to either way.
Okay. That's a useful thing to kind of remember. The metric of the success of a record is whether or not people dance.
Yes.
How have you got used to that? How have you kind of come round to look at that away from making music for sort of...
I've always wanted to do that. You know, I've really always wanted. And so when I work with people who overthink it, like Mark, for example, you know, he was brilliant, but it was like, I'll tell you what happened with Mark Bryden from Moloko. When I met him, he had actually made, he was at the very beginning of like house music in this country, you know, and he'd made some hits like in that form very early on. And Sheffield was a furnace for that. And each one of his mates had all been involved in building Fon Studios and all this. And they were all like, it was a very kind of communal thing. And of course, that never lasts and people always fall out. And there was petty jealousies going on. And he was not like that. I mean, he was very much is a man's man, you know, and he was never somebody who got involved in like talking about people behind their back and bitching about people and, you know, the little petty kind of nonsense that was going on. And I could sense when I met him that he was absolutely tired of it. And I was like, F all that, you know, bugger all that. Let's just be really like, I'll say stupid shit and, you know, you do whatever you like with beats and, you know what I mean? And he just grabbed that with both hands when I look back at it. And this was not me coming from a point of view of like I'd been in stage school for years and desperately wanted to be a singer or anything like that.
Well, it's kind of worked out reasonably well, I think it's safe to say. And just on that point about, I suppose, gauging success, and it's interesting, you know, Augustine was asking you earlier about this idea of where that gauge comes on the reaction on the dance floor of people. It's very immediate. It's quite a purist thing, really.
Purist, yeah.
I sense that you don't worry about these things.
But, and it's not so egotistical, you know?
Well, no, but
it's also
if
you're
had,
removing
if you
a lot
sold,
of ego.
If you sell a lot of records,
like
but then you do something different, and is the sort of the handbrake come off creatively? Does that bother you? And, you know, there's some artists, you get the impression that if they enjoy a very big commercial success, say, that they almost come to sometimes almost resent that material because it became too well known, or it maybe brought their music to a different demographic.
Through all that,
but does
obviously.
Are you conflicted about it at all, or are you very sanguine about
there's
it?
There's been all sorts of conflictions along the way, all sorts.
You seem to just
wear
it very lightly.
I've never felt successful. Still don't.
Really?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think we felt like Sing It Back was successful, or even Time Is Now was successful, but we didn't feel we were successful as Moloko, as a group, that we had successfully managed to make our mark indelibly, you know, this is what we were trying to say and it's come across. Do you know, there are things that, games that we didn't play, obviously, that's obvious. And one of the most obvious games we didn't play was making me go really forward in the duo, like, which I'm grateful for because, you know, in the end, I haven't got any Me Too stories. You know, I haven't got any, like, I was never molested by anyone, or, you know what I mean? I was never put into any kind of dangerous situations. I was always left to feel very powerfully equal to him and, you know, equal to anyone I was talking to, and not for sale in that sense.
What about what's next? Who knows which turns we shall follow?
Next, more directing, and hopefully directing for other people and outside of other realms of my own work, and working with performers and actually performing by proxy through other people. I really want to do that. I've got a massive wish in my heart for that. So that's that. And then I've started another record, which is super duper exciting. I haven't worked with this person on a Roisin Murphy record before, and it's going to be fantastic. Keep going. Just keep working.
Watch this space. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Before we move on, though, let's enjoy another of Roisin's new tracks. This is Like, from Roisin Murphy and Maurice Fulton.
Caught up in the middle of a sea. Never could deliver on a dream. Brought up in the middle of a scheme. Never could get clean.
Roisin Murphy and Maurice Fulton there with Like, and we'll be hearing from the artist Mary Kelly after this. American artist Mary Kelly has been creating conceptual works for over 50 years that have advanced the dialogue surrounding themes ranging from feminism to postmodernism. Famously, her show Postpartum Document caused a sensation in the 70s at London's ICA for featuring parts of her son's used diaper, or nappy, as we would say on the side of the pond, in its exploration of the mother-child relationship.
Her latest show is Face to Face at London's Pippi Holdsworth Gallery. It explores images of war and conflict, featuring works ranging from brightly designed collages made in the 1960s to Kelly's trademark monumental wall hangings, made from the most unlikely of materials. Lint from the tumble dryer. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Mary Kelly at the gallery to learn more.
This is a rather unusual show for me because I'm a project-based artist. I do large works on one theme, usually, and this is a survey of works selected from different projects over a period of time beginning in 1966 to the present, showing the way that I've been concerned with themes of social justice over that time. Even I'm surprised by the work that's in here from 1966.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that. The period of work, it's a span of decades. So when you put a show like this together, as you say, it's not a typical one for you. Is it an immediately instinctive process for you to find that theme, or does it take months, years to sort of find the thread?
Well, I think there's been a recurring interest over all these years, specifically in questions of violence, scarcity, and war. I always think of the artwork like an argument. In fact, I'd rather not speak about it because I think I made a visual proposition, right? But if I want to push that to some sort of transcription here, then I would say that the works from the 60s were demonstrations of my political awakening. I was very young. In my early 20s, I finished graduate school in Florence, and then I had my first teaching job in Beirut, in Lebanon. It was my encounter with works of Sartre and Fanon at the time that made me want to do things that were visually significant as far as working that argument through. It's really before my best-known work, which is Postpartum Document, before conceptual art. So there's like pop art, and there's the kind of the beginnings of conceptual art, which I was very drawn to.
I mean, you mentioned there that you're not perhaps so keen on explicitly explaining the artwork because you've made the artwork and people can maybe make their own judgment on it. But there are over or underlying themes, such as the collection that I'm looking at right now, these super cool graphic pieces that all come under that banner scarcity. When I was thinking about that issue of scarcity, which I understand that Sartre had a hand in that theme, I mean, we see the gap between sort of poor and rich getting ever wider these days. When you were working on these pieces under that banner scarcity in the 60s, did you think that in 2018 it would be perhaps an even more prominent, possibly worse issue? Would you think you'd be talking to me about it and it would have got worse?
Of course not, because I was a child of the 60s and 70s, and there was tremendous optimism in, I think that's how it was different from the current time. There's always been violence and suffering, but the way that we felt it was necessary and could be done, you could change that situation, I think distinguishes it from the difficulty of addressing it now. And it's almost, if you want, you know, my personal view, an ecological issue. If you think of it like human ecology, you can't have that much war, that much destruction and traumatization and maiming of a generation coming up and think you'll be able to produce the good citizens for the democracy. It just kind of parallels what we know about climate change and about the people talk about the Anthropocene, like we're beginning to see a wider view of history where the impact of the human intervention is now registered. And I think in the 70s, at that time, there was a chance in a different way. Although there's many, you know, things you could be optimistic about in the current moment, but that's how I feel. It's very different.
This might be a bit of a grim thought, but do you think that certain elements of sort of, I guess, human civilization are cyclical? Because it's interesting, I remember speaking to someone about the German rock band Can, and they came from the Germany of the 60s, and they were obviously so appalled with Nazi Germany that their parents had embraced and stuff like that, that they were just absolutely adamant about refusing that reality and making something, as you sort of alluded to, something optimistic and creative and new, and that wasn't shaped by that atrocity. So, I mean, you have these like dawns of optimism that come after really terrible things. I mean, guess what I'm getting at is that it feels like you have to get to the bottom before you start building up again.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly seems true. In terms of if you take something like Me Too right now and look back to 70s feminism at the beginning of the movement, there was a lot of essentialism, right, of black and white position takings and consciousness raising, and then people got more subtle about the questions that they asked. And I think at the beginning of movements, you have that repeating now in a way. But I do think it means that the more complex questions will soon follow.
I wanted to talk about some of your work sort of highlighting issues of gender. I mean, very famously, you sort of attracted the press in the 70s of incorporating a diaper, which obviously in the UK we call a nappy, into your work, which shocked people, and it, which is absurd because it's such a essential part of the human experience, you know, taking care of a child. I mean, we're talking in a week where gender and issues of that nature have been all over the news with the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. I just wonder, did you watch any of that, and do you have thoughts on that today?
Of course. I think, well, this is the most difficult problem of your generation, especially when it comes to women. What we've recognized is that you have to constantly, constantly renegotiate it. You can never take it, you know, for granted. But I think our thinking about things got very sophisticated during the 80s and 90s about sexuality, right? But it's not, it doesn't line up with the political situation in general. That wasn't something we had to negotiate at my time because everything was happening at once. We didn't have the ideas, we had to invent those, we had to change our own personal lives, we had to change the legislation. But of course that's not exactly what's happening now. And I was extremely disappointed, you know, by the way that was handled. But it's to be expected because you have extreme right-wing Republicans who are controlling the House and the Senate. And you have perhaps in the United States and in Europe this rise of authoritarian populism, which is a backdrop that we can't, you know, discount when you're asking these questions. But it's not my expertise, right, to go into that.
It would be great if you could talk me through some of the processes we can see here, because although these are really integrally important concepts for about a lot of the ways we go about our lives and the way that we break our lives, I mean, conflict in general is not a pleasant thing, the actual presentation of them is super sort of innovative and bright. Talk me through some of the processes. I'm especially, of course, intrigued about your techniques with lint. How do you make these huge artworks using a material like that?
Well, wanting to find a medium that was suggestive of the kind of affect you want to deal with questions of violence was quite difficult. I often draw on domestic kind of materials and processes, but when I saw the lint in the dryer, I thought, that would be great if I could make something that worked every time. This would be ephemeral enough, you know, to grasp. In the first instance, I was dealing with cases of violence to women and children in conditions of war that were brought to the War Crimes Tribunal. So that is the work that began using the lint. Then you see I have a later work from just this last year. I did two of them that are about drone attacks, one in Pakistan, one in Yemen. The one that you see here is famously about the wedding party that was accidentally bombed. But again, to use the lint process and to introduce color, which is rather brutally eerie, I think, you know, like the computer screen, it had a purpose. Not just a designerly effect, if I could say that. I'm very cautious about my use of colors. I've also used this medium for talking about historical memory. So the large work that you see there is the World War, like the moment when I was born. The color is more subtle there, because you see I've used the silver and the lighter gray and the black kind of grounds to create a kind of perspective. This is the bombed out library, and that would be the light coming into the top. But with this, I did three images to span really my lifetime, the time I was born, when my son was born, which is near the time of 68, and then the sort of millennials, and that image is the Arab Spring from 2011. Now, those three images are things that are very known. We all have registered this image of the library, of 68 revolution, of that kind of constellation of the Arab Spring, of lights in a circle swirling on your phone, right? So this is why I use the projected light noise with those images. They're very large and cinematic, and you're not sure what you're looking at. It could be a projection, because I want you to be slightly suspicious of them, you know, to wonder, what am I seeing? You know, when is this, where am I? And then you walk up close and you see the stuff, and that registers real time, you know, duration, washing, you know, taking place in this kind of concrete reality, as it were, of the stuff.
I'm just curious about the actual techniques. How do you get lint onto the wall like that and make it into these incredibly graphic, incredibly communicative statements? What's the actual technical process? Is it all from the tumble dryer? Where does it come from?
From the tumble dryer, you take out the filter screen and put the vinyl letters on, and then put it back in mirror reversal, put on the whitewash, that goes through, then put on the black wash. They collect around the vinyl, and then you, when you turn it out, it's like cast in low relief with the text in intaglio. I don't touch it or stamp it or mess with it. It's like an assisted ready-made, and I like the directness of that. When it's an image, it's more complicated because I have to render that image in vinyl, right, first, and then build it up over these small units, because each unit of the work conforms to the scale of the dryer filter. But for me, that's important. I like the way that you can recognize visually that this has a time, that has a structure that's over time. It takes 10,000 pounds of washing in about 6 months to do it. I did just start out with my own clothes, black and white, cotton, old. And I did think, oh, I'd like to try to do this faster, right? So I went out and bought some things that would produce a lot of fluff. And then I discovered it didn't work. It just had to be the old stuff because it had to be a very fine grain that went through. And I went and looked for industrial dryers, and I thought, oh, maybe I can have a big... No, it doesn't work. You know, it was just this very homey little process that ended up having the results that I wanted. So the time has to be put in. However, I'm always thinking, who can I get to do some of this washing for me?
I know that you're sort of interested in how the media conveys ideas, such as, let's say, conflict, and how it gets kind of repeated in society and how society digests that. Do you see your works as, in some sense, though, perhaps an amplification of some of that strange media warping and bias of issues? Because obviously, to even engage with it is to be sort of part of the game, if you know what I mean?
I do, very much. This is an issue that I need to be very careful about, which brings me kind of back to the medium and why it's important to make it real stuff and not digital, right? It's, I suppose, archaic in some way. But I think, as Benjamin pointed out once, this can be somewhat redemptive in certain moments to use that. Because I think it's not... I can't just repeat it in the same way or same material as the media, because, of course, what I want you to do is to think quite differently about that.
And so the conflicts that you sort of identify in an exhibition like this, you mentioned Sarajevo and others, how firsthand are some of these and how distant are some of them in the same breath?
Well, I have a personal link in that, I do think that it's not in the sense of like living there, but I always, well, I believe for artists you kind of have to acknowledge your subjective investment, and you kind of have to start there. And all of the works I did in the Mea Culpa series about the war crimes tribunal, they all had to do with mother and children, which doesn't mean that that's the only thing going on there, but it's what was absolutely capturing my emotional attention. So I started with that. With the trilogy piece, the Second World War, I mean, I actually was born just as the war started. Who knows what happens to a child who's kind of brought up when your father is being sent to war, right? And all of your kind of family life is disrupted. So that's an important point. But actually in the first drone piece I did, I was extremely moved by the two grandchildren that came to testify that the drone had killed their grandmother, and I'm a grandmother. And in this situation where she was killed, she was in the process of teaching them how to identify ochre when it was ripe and things in the field. And I was thinking about how you pass on knowledge, you know, and how a whole culture is devastated through this. So that it's linked to the wedding party that was bombed as well, because there's a culture, there's a tradition, there's over time, a destruction, you know, that we talked about before. So that was my personal kind of link in these cases.
Mary Kelly there speaking to Tom Hall, and Face to Face is at Pippi Holdsworth Gallery in London until the 3rd of November. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Delightfully horrifying is how one outlet has described our next guest's work. Thomas Morris is a medical historian and author who digests both the incredible feats of modern medicine and the slightly more ludicrous ones of the past in one dose. Those tales make up his new book, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth.
It looks at some of the harebrained, but thankfully historic thinking in medicine that's got us to where we are today, including mystery illnesses such as peeing through one's nose, and those aforementioned explosions that rocked the world of dentistry in the 19th century. And he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Thomas. This book, as I understand it, was born of a series of blog posts.
Yes. I mean, the moment I can identify pretty clearly in my mind the moment at which I decided to do something along these lines. And it was about 3 years ago. I was writing a book about the history of heart surgery. And I was in the very early stages of writing this book, which basically involved sitting in a medical library just opposite Euston Station and reading a lot of very old medical journals. And I was trying to get through a rather tedious article about heart disease written in about 1860. And my eye strayed onto the following page. And you know the way it is, you're reading something quite serious and worthy, and you always see something that's much more attractive than what you're actually meant to be reading. And this story was about a man who, in fact, it was about 1826, this story. It was about a man from Winchester who was just going about his daily business, and he wasn't looking quite where he was going. And he got run over by a cart laden with bricks. And this impact had resulted in an injury so extraordinary that when he arrived at hospital, it was described as the whole of his intestines were protruding into his scrotum, which had become swollen to a quite grotesque size, yeah, in the words of the doctor who wrote about it. And I saw this first paragraph and I thought, I can't stop reading this. I want to know exactly what happens. And actually, the surprise, spoiler alert, is that he was absolutely fine. So I started a blog, and I've now collected about 400 of these stories, ranging from about 1640 or so to about 1900. And yeah, this book is a sort of collection of my favourites, really.
What are your sensibilities that mean this just resonates with you? Because it is slightly, it's an interesting area to pick through, precisely as you described. You need to have quite a phlegmatic constitution to deal with it. Is there a certain type of character for whom these stories seem to hit the spot best?
Well, I've tried to pick quite a range of stories in this collection. So, I mean, I hope it will appeal to various types of sensibility. There are some, it must be said, that require quite a strong stomach. But there are others that are kind of quite touching and don't really require you to have any tolerance for gore or anything of that nature. I mean, when I started off, I was really looking for the most unusual stories. And there are some things that were going on in these journal articles where you just had no idea that surgery so sophisticated was going on at so early a date. There's a case from the 1640s, which it was described by John Evelyn, the great diarist, as the drunken Dutchman who swallowed a knife. In fact, he said it was the knife that was taken out of the drunken Dutchman's guts. And what happened here was this young man who was woke up very hungover one morning and decided that the way to make himself feel better was to tickle the back of his throat with something to make himself sick. You know, a time-honoured technique, if not a particularly wise one. And he decided that the right implement to do this with was a knife, which he, for some reason, chose to just kind of dangle down his throat point first, and the inevitable happened, he swallowed it. And amazingly, even in the 1640s, the Dutch surgeons were sophisticated enough to be able to cut this item out of his stomach without anaesthetic. This is an incredibly sophisticated thing to be happening so early in medical history. And so things like that as well, which, you know, I suppose it is a little macabre, but things which are in themselves curiosities in terms of the sophistication or the imagination that's been employed in treating somebody, that's also something I wanted to bring into it.
And we should say just quickly, to quote from some of the spectators of the time in this very case you describe, the successful operation viewed by all that were standing by and greatly applauded, both by them and the patient himself.
Yes.
Glad he was so enthusiastic about it.
That's what's really leaped out at me from the book, is kind of both the register of the entries, of these journal entries, which I haven't much experience of kind of contemporary medical literature, but they're all written with this sort of rather sort of formal, slightly incredulous, almost quite wry sort of tone that I don't know if I'm projecting it onto them or if I'm really reading it there, but it just tickles me so much. But also, you know, none of these people were being, or very few, were being operated on with any sort of anaesthetic. It is remarkable.
Exactly. And most of the stories in here, the advent of anaesthetics is the late 1840s. The first anaesthetic operations took place in the United States in about 1847. And chloroform was first used here in 1848 or 1849. So it wasn't until the 1850s that anaesthesia was used with any regularity. And most of the stories in this book date from before that era. I mean, even there's a very serious operation that took place in the 1850s, which involved removing a large slug of metal from somebody's chest. And the surgeon actually did this. He removed this item from underneath the heart. And he started this operation without anaesthetic. And at some point during it, he thought, well, actually, maybe it's to stop him moving around so much on the table. Maybe I'd better give him some ether. But even then, I think that's 1858. Even then, it wasn't thought to be a kind of routine thing you had to do. So, yeah, it's an entirely different ritual, if you like, from what we now understand an operation to be. And in fact, in the case of the drunken Dutchman who swallows the knife, there's a ritual described before they start the operation where they said prayers over his prostrate body. And I quite like this idea because it's almost a parallel with the anaesthetist putting the patient to sleep. But instead of that, you have the surgeons all crowded around the table saying a prayer over his body before they get going.
The one that really, really leapt out was the sad case of Hu Lu, who was a man who came over from China with a really devastatingly gigantic, it's called a tumour, but you make clear in the book that a tumour doesn't necessarily refer to a cancerous growth, but is a kind of archaic name for a mass.
Well, that story was a real eye-opener for me. It was a very celebrated case at the time. It was reported in all the main medical journals and beyond that as well, in all sorts of kind of non-medical literature. And you learn a lot from many of these stories, not just about how medicine has evolved, but also about the ways in which the world has changed. So this was a story of a Chinese peasant who came from a very small village, and he spent, I think, 2 days walking from this village to the first hospital founded in China, which was offering Western medicine to Chinese residents free of charge. And the superintendent of this hospital was actually an eye surgeon. So this was very much outside his field of expertise. And he knew that his old mentor in London, a great surgeon called Sir Astley Cooper, he was at the time the most celebrated surgeon certainly in Britain and maybe in Europe, he knew that he'd be able to help this person. And they raised the funds. It was a sort of charity appeal. They raised the funds to send this Chinese peasant all the way from there to London. And you don't really tend to think of that sort of thing having happened in the 19th century, the idea that a patient would travel halfway across the world to seek the best medical treatment in another country. You think that's a sort of modern phenomenon. And then he arrives in London and this celebrated operation takes place. But it's also surgery as spectacle. The idea that almost 700 people, and can you imagine the sort of microbiology implications of that, 800, you know, pairs of lungs breathing out their germs over the operating table. But it also had quite a big impact, that operation, because it's what's known as the age of heroic surgery, when surgeons were kind of really gung-ho about what they could do, that their techniques were getting ever more sophisticated, and they thought they could pretty much operate on, there were no bounds to what they thought they could do. And there was such an outrage about the fact that this poor man had come over and then had been operated on for the best part of 2 hours without anaesthetic and died in front of 700 people, that there was a big backlash. People wrote into the journals saying this can't be allowed to happen again. And I think it's probably safe to say that between then, which is the early 1830s and the 1850s, when chloroform and ether came in and anaesthetics became a routine part of surgery, that in that period, surgeons became a little more circumspect about who they operated on and why.
Tom, I wanted to ask you about another thing. It's funny there, you just reflect on things that we maybe think of as very much of the modern day, but actually have been around for rather longer. And there was an interesting reflection you made at the end of the chapter, I think, about the amphibious baby, which is about this idea that actually we've always been blending fact and fiction, particularly in certain aspects of medicine and medical practice. And you reflect again that, you know, the likes of Mark Twain, other sort of journalists who would be rather playful with how they would use the newspapers to sort of sow a bit of mischief. Is it quite instructive sometimes to reflect on these older cases and see that the same thing, tabloid cheekiness, misleading, fake news, I suppose, you do utter that phrase in the book, it's kind of been around longer than we might have expected.
Yes, and in fact, a lot of what you read, particularly in the very early medical journals, has to be taken with a pinch of salt. There are various different reasons to that, actually. I mean, the medical journal as a form really started to emerge in the late 18th century, and it was a way for doctors to share their knowledge with each other, their knowledge and experience. So if they were trying a new treatment, they wanted to let other doctors know whether it had been effective. But also, if they encountered an unusual case, they wanted to put it on record so that if another doctor came across something similar, they would know there was a precedent and maybe that might guide how they would go about the treatment of the patient. But it wasn't really until the 19th century, and really quite late in the 19th century, that the modern objective standards of observation, the idea that experiment had to be objective and that the physician's own opinion shouldn't really enter into it too much, came about. So in the 18th century, doctors were quite happy to put on record something which somebody had told them. And the thing that somebody had told them might be just what the patient's parents had said, or a friend of a friend, or a doctor in the next village had heard from one of his patients. So you get these completely outrageous tales. They're known, there's a whole class of them known as bosom serpents. And these are patients who were said to have an animal living inside them. I mean, the bosom serpent is, you know, that's what it sounds like. But also you get sometimes entire colonies of insects living inside a patient, lizards, snakes, all sorts of different creatures living. Sometimes they've kind of been swallowed as eggs, and then they go through every stage of metamorphosis inside the body, and then they emerge. Now, in reality, there isn't a single authenticated case because they simply can't. It's physically impossible. But there are dozens of these cases on record because doctors are quite willing to put them on record if they had it on good authority from somebody else. So you get those where actually it was a doctor in good faith writing down something they thought had really happened. But then, yes, you do get these kind of smaller class of cases which are genuine frauds. So the case you alluded to, this amphibious infant, it ended up in a medical journal, but it started in a Chicago newspaper. Quite a long detailed account of a man who claimed that he had taught first of all, a litter of puppies. He turned them amphibious so that they could swim underwater for up to 20 minutes at a time. And then based on what he claimed were entirely rational theoretical grounds, he did the same for his newborn son. And there's this incredible account from a journalist who claims that he or she has been to this person's house and watched open-mouthed as the child has swum underwater picking up sweets from the bottom of a large tank. There's absolutely nothing to corroborate this story, and in the absence of any other good evidence for it. I mean, it was the golden age of the newspaper hoax, and I suspect the hand of a wannabe Mark Twain behind it.
I'm seldom rendered speechless on this programme, but Thomas, you've done it several times over, certainly with that last one. There are many more where that came from. Thomas Morris is the author. The book is The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. It's out now, it's published by Bantam Press, and it's quite the read. Thomas, thanks for coming to tell us about it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Augustine, that is your edition 483 of the Monocle Weekly, and that's all you have for this week. The programme was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Augustine Macellari.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.